Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 21st, 1998. In the Creekside Room this afternoon is Ana Maria Pineda, session titled Our Lady of Guadalupe. Let's listen in.
Let me introduce myself to you. Some of you have already heard this part of the introduction, but I will do it again. My name is Ana Maria Pineda. I'm a Sister of Mercy, Roman Catholic. And I always share that I was born in Central America, in Salvador, and I came to the States when I was 2 years old, so I was quite tiny, probably about this height. And we arrived in San Francisco, and there's a great neighborhood in San Francisco. We have a lot of the people from Latin America living there, and the area, the neighborhood is called the Mission. And it's called the Mission because one of the early Franciscan missions, Mission Dolores, is there in that area. And I always tell the story that I must have been about 21 or 22 when I realized that that was the reason why it was called the Mission. Because we very affectionately always said, oh, La Mission, the Mission, that's our neighborhood, that's our home, and that's our area. So I grew up in a very Hispanic neighborhood with lots of reminders that to be Hispanic means not to be just one thing, but a variety of countries and personalities and different histories. And tonight I'm going to share with you a very special part of the Hispanic history and tradition. It's a treasure of ours. It's something that we hold very dear and very important to many of us, particularly those who are of Mexican background. But it seems that this treasure is so special that many of us who are not Mexican have adopted it, like part of our own devotion and our religious practice. And that is the story and the event and the tradition of Our Lady of Guadalupe. In order to understand why Our Lady of Guadalupe is so important to Hispanics and particularly the Mexican community, we have to understand part of the history, where it takes place. If you don't know the history, if we don't know the significance of it, then we lose the treasure of why Guadalupe is so vital and so important. And it all goes back to 1492. I'm sure many of you know what happened in 1492. Columbus sails the ocean blue. Some of us always remember that little rhyme, so it helped. It helped in exams, you know, when they told you, what is the date? We knew, 1492. Well, 1492, Columbus sails the ocean blue, and he's looking for treasures. He's looking for treasures of the Indies. But instead of that, he discovers discovers in quotes, what is called the New World, or the Americas. And with that discovery, you have a whole process of conquest that occurs. Spain comes and gradually conquers the people of the Americas. There are a couple of significant dates. There's a lot of history, so I'm only going to give you a little thumbprint to put it in context. The conquest doesn't happen overnight, it's gradual. So in 1519, Cortes arrives in Mexico City, which is the heart of the Aztec capital, the Aztec Empire. It's a wonderful civilization where the Aztecs have built incredible temples, cities that even the Spaniards marveled at when they arrived. Some of them wrote about it. They said, you know, we arrived and we saw this awesome city built of stone, this incredible pyramid. We just could not believe. And it was a society that was just so developed and so marvelous. So he arrives, and within 3 years, by 1521, little by little, he conquers the capital of Mexico City. And in 1521, you have the final defeat of the capital of Mexico City, or the Aztec Empire. The conquest is a terrible experience. And some of what happened is recorded. Some of the accounts of what happened is recorded. And I'm just going to share a little bit with you. The battle that takes place in 1521 was a terrible one because it was a religious battle in many ways. The indigenous peoples believed that their whole world was supported by the power of the gods. And if this whole world could crumble and be destroyed, it was because the gods of those that came to conquer were stronger. But it dismantles a whole world that is pulled and cut together by this religious belief in the sacred, in the divine. That they were a very religious people. So when they see their city destroyed, the accounts tell us that it was so terrible that the people were actually starving. And all they had to eat was the grass that was left upon the ground. So women and children and older people and men were just eating the grass that was left on the ground. And the city itself was surrounded by water canals. And the accounts tell us that the water canals were bloodied. They were red with blood of all the victims that had been killed in this terrible battle. And they were filled with the bodies of the victims of this battle. And children were left orphaned, so you could hear the cries of the children and the weeping of women who were taken and mistreated, raped, and abused. And the temples that were standing, that were the pride and the glory of this civilization, and the sacred sites of their worship, were burned and destroyed and torn apart. It was so horrible that the people wanted really to die. And there's a phrase that's reported, and it's the following. Please let us die. Let us disappear. For our gods have died. There was no reason for them to want to live because all that they held dear had been destroyed. And so this is what they were praying for, death, rather than to live in this incomplete manner. Shortly after, you have 1524, and you have the first 12 missionaries arriving. And they come with the wonderful plan, from their point of view, to talk about the Christian God. They wanted to tell the indigenous world about the Christian God. And when they arrive, these men, the Franciscans, 12 of them, they were called the 12, or los doce. In Spanish, that means the 12. And they were supposed to imitate the 12 disciples of Jesus, the 12 apostles, and do things like the apostles did to go on and spread the good news of God, of a loving God. When they arrive, Cortes himself thinks and behaves like a missionary. He wants to help. And so he tells them that he wants them to do something, and that is, he wants them to begin writing like a religious book or a catechism or an instruction so that they can begin to talk to the indigenous people about the Christian God. So for 10 days, they are busily writing this religious instruction.
In what language?
In Spanish, which they do.
Are the Aztecs speaking Spanish?
No.
Oh, okay.
But they are going to use some translators to help them. And this, they get up and they tell them about the Christian God and how they've come from a very far away land to talk about this God, and that their king has sent them, and the king is the Pope. And they want to tell them because they want to make sure that they know about the true God, that the gods that they're worshiping and celebrating are not the true gods. So the wise men who are gathered to listen to this instruction, they are the ones who were being prepared for a very special role in their community, and that was the role of keeping the memory of the story of their people. This was a very special task. It was very specialized. So the wise men that were chosen for this particular task, they were chosen when they were very young, and they were taught in a very special way to keep in their hearts the memory of their people and the stories of everything that had to do with their world, even the accounts of the artists that were part of their world, and those who wrote special books with painted figures and so forth. So they listen very attentively, but they in fact don't feel that they are the ones that should be listening, because the ones that have really been prepared, the wise men, have been killed when the Spanish arrived, because it was those men who had the history of the people, and this was a very easy way of trying to finalize the defeat of the people, so they had no memory of who they were. But there were the apprentice, those who had been trying to learn how to be. So when they finish hearing the whole instruction, one of them, one of the wise men, gets up and he tells them that. And then the region is part of the story, because it gives you an idea. I have a little bit of a cold, so every once in a while I'm going to have a little sip of water. The wise man gets up and he says, "Our lords are very esteemed lords. They were very courteous people, so they treated even those who had come to conquer them in a very courteous manner. Great hardships have you endured to reach this land." So we know that you've come from a very from far away, and that it has taken you much trouble to come. "Here before you, we ignorant people contemplate you." Ignorant because they were only the apprentice, not the real wise men. "Through an interpreter, we reply. We exhale the breath and the words of the Lord of the close vicinity." So even the breath that we have is the breath that God has given us. And that is the God of the close vicinity, the God that we feel so close to us, so part of our lives. "Because of him, we dare to do this. For this reason, we place ourselves in danger. You said that we know not the Lord of the close vicinity, to whom the heavens and the earth belong. You said that our gods are not true gods. New words are these that you speak. Because of them, we are disturbed. Because of them, we are troubled. For our ancestors before us, who lived upon the earth, were unaccustomed to speak thus. From them have we inherited our pattern of life, which in truth did they hold, in reverence they held. They honored our gods. They taught us all their rules of worship, all their ways of honoring the gods. Thus before them do we prostrate ourselves. In their names we bleed ourselves." That was a way of us showing a sacrificial offering to the gods. "Our oaths we keep, incense we burn, and sacrifices we offer." They continue, and another part of it reads, "We know on whom life is dependent, on whom the perpetuation of the race depends, by whom begetting is determined, by whom growth is made possible, how it is that one must invoke, how it is that one must pray. Here, O Lord, do nothing to our people that will bring misfortune upon them, that will cause them to perish. Calm and amiable, consider, O Lords, whatever is best. We cannot be trampled. And yet, we certainly do not believe. We do not accept your teachings as truth, even though this may offend you. Here are the lords, those who rule, those who sustain, whose duty is to the entire world. Is it not enough that we have already lost, that our way of life has been taken away, has been destroyed? What now? Do you want to also take away our God, our gods? Do you want to take away our life? In the account, this is the last spoken word that we know of. The reason we don't know anything more about it is because the written account that is recorded later, part of it is lost, and it's the part that follows. But what we do know is that the wise men return to their own families, to their own communities, and they share with the community the conversation that had taken place with the missionaries. And when the community finishes hearing what has occurred, the account tells us that they fell into an incredible stupor. They are stunned. They cannot believe their ears what they have heard. And it is almost difficult for them to come out of this stupor. And finally they say, no, I'm sorry, we cannot accept. We cannot accept what they are telling us because we have a God. We have the sacred. So the next day, the wise men go back and give the news to the missionaries. And that is the final thing that we know. What we do know from other accounts is that the missionary endeavor does take place, and slowly some of the Indians are baptized, not necessarily by their own desire or wish. Others are taught about what it means to be baptized, and they slowly accept. But it's a very reluctant acceptance, that people feel defeated. They have nothing left. They are destroyed. They are dispirited. Everything that could mean anything to them has been taken away. And this is where the conquest, the final conquest is 1521. 10 years later, 1531, on a Saturday morning, very, very early, before dawn has even taken place, on December the 9th, there is an older man, an older Indian man, who is preparing to become Christian, to be baptized. And he is on his way to Mass. He's traveling from the mountain area that's on the board here. He lives on the outskirts. And here in the center of Mexico City is the church. But here's where the temples of the Aztec Empire used to stand. And on top of that rubble, they built the church. So he was on his way to Mass, and he circles this little hill. This little hill is called Tepeyac. It has an Indian name. And on that hill, before the Spaniards came, it was a very special religious site where they worshipped Tonantzin. I'll explain a little bit later the meaning of Tonantzin. But Tonantzin was, the indigenous people believed in one sacred entity, or two dimensions, the female and the male. And in order to try to comprehend something that is so other, so more than we could ever possibly grasp of the sacred, of the divine, of the deity, they used to use several names to describe the female dimension and the male dimension. Like we say, Jesus the Good Shepherd, Jesus the Light. We have different titles to try and describe the fullness of Jesus. Well, they would do the same thing. And one of the names for the female dimension of the sacred was Tonantzin, which meant our Venerable Mother. And this was the ancient site of Tonantzin. But now it lay in rubbles because the conquistadores had destroyed it. So Juan Diego is coming around, and all of a sudden he hears this absolutely exquisite music. It's a singing that he has never heard before. He stops, he's just so taken by it, and he begins to ask himself, where am I? Am I still on earth or is it paradise? Have I gone to the land that our ancestors spoke about? And the music is so beautiful that he is invited by the music itself to go to see the source of the music. And he follows the sound of the music. Now, in the indigenous world, music was a very special symbol or reality for the sacred. And there's an expression in Spanish, flor y canto, flower and song. That word or that phrase means the spiritual, the sacred. So whenever they used it, what they were saying was something spiritual, something very sacred is about to happen. And in the account, they hear the music. So it's an announcement that something very special is about to be revealed. Juan Diego follows the sound, and there he finds, in the account, a very beautiful woman. She's standing, and it's a radiant appearance. And this woman is very kind and compassionate in her appearance. And she talks to him. That wonderful thing about the way she talks to him is that she's speaking to him in his Indian language, which is very inviting. He feels at home. He feels taken into account. He feels respected by the fact that she talks to him in his own language. And she says, Juan Dieguito, Juan Dieguito. We think that, in fact, she really said, Juan Sin, the Z-I-N-N, which means you who are venerable, you who are worth something. It's a very special ending that designates a reverential treatment. And she tells him that she wants him for a special task, for a special job. And what it is, she wants him to go to talk to the bishop and ask him to build a temple on the spot where she is standing. And Juan Diego is just so overwhelmed that someone is paying this wonderful attention to him and treating him this way, that right away he decides that yes, he could probably do that. So he says yes, and he would do this, and he says goodbye to her, and he leaves. And he takes the trip down to Mexico City. Now, Mexico City is several hours away walking by foot, so it's very early, and he makes his way down. And finally, when he gets to Mexico City, he goes to the palace of the bishop, and he wants to see the bishop. So he's asking the servants, could he please see the bishop? The servants are also Indians, and what happens tells you how terrible the defeat is, because the very Indians that are of his own blood treat him very badly and don't want to let him come in to see the bishop. So he has to plead a lot. And finally, after waiting for a very long time, they let him come. So Juan Diego comes in, and he tells the bishop exactly what has happened, and that the lady, this beautiful lady, wants a temple built there. And the bishop listens to him and doesn't think that what Juan Diego is telling him is really accurate or is true. So he says, you know, my son, why don't you come back another day when I have more time to listen to you, and you can tell me the account again. So Juan Diego leaves, and he's very upset. He feels like he hasn't done what he said he would do. And he goes back up to where Tepeyac is, and he meets the lady again. And this time, in his conversation with the lady, he says the following. I'm going to read little bits and pieces of the account to you so that you can have an idea. He says, I went where you sent me to fulfill your request. It was with great difficulty that I entered the room of the bishop. I gave him your message just as you had told me to do. He received me kindly and he heard me attentively, but he did not believe as true what I told him. He told me to come again and he would hear me out slowly. My dear lady, I understood perfectly well in the way in which he responded that he believes that perhaps it's an invention of mine that you want them to build a temple here. This I beg you, entrust your mission to one of the important persons who is well known, respected, and esteemed, so that they may believe him. You know that I am a nobody, a pile of old sticks, just like a bunch of leaves. I am nothing. You have set me to walk in places where I do not belong. Forgive me, and please do not be angry with me, my lady and mistress. And the lady answers him, listen, my son, the smallest of my children. And that phrase is really important. When she says the smallest of my children, she doesn't mean he's a little boy. He's an older man. What she's saying is, I know that you have been treated badly. I know that you feel terrible. I know that they don't respect you. I know that you feel like a nobody. But I want you to know that you are a somebody and that I have chosen you to be the messenger. I have chosen you to help me in this task. And you have to realize that even though I can pick anyone I want, it's you that I've chosen. So with this kind of conversation and words from the lady, he feels once again that he can do it, that he can do this mission. So the next day, he once again goes back to talk to the bishop. And he tells the bishop the same story. He gives the account exactly the way it has happened to him. He doesn't leave anything out. He says to him this time, "You know, my son, let me ask you this. You come back again, but this time I want a sign from the lady so that I can believe that what you are telling me is true." So Juan Diego leaves. And he feels awful about this again because it's very clear to him that no matter how the bishop tells him, basically the bishop doesn't believe him. So he goes back to the lady and he tells her what has happened. And the lady says, "That's fine. Tomorrow you come back again in the morning, early in the morning, and I will give you the sign that he's asking for." But Juan Diego gets home that evening and he has a problem waiting for him, a dilemma. And that dilemma is that his uncle is very sick and is dying. And his uncle says, "Juan Diego, I am dying. I want you to do me this favor. Go tomorrow morning very early and go and get a priest for me so that he can accompany me as I'm dying." So Juan Diego has this terrible dilemma. Have you ever felt that way? You have two things you need to do, and maybe at the same time, how are you going to do it, right? So Juan Diego doesn't know what to do. So all night long he's wrestling with what is he going to do the following morning. Well, the following morning he thinks he's come upon a wonderful solution. He says, "I'm going very early. I'm going to go down to Mexico City quickly as I could take, which would be several hours, get a priest for my uncle because I have this responsibility. And when I finish, then I'll go back and take care of what the lady wants of me." So with this in mind, he sets out. And he starts again, coming down from where he lives, around the little hill, but then he decides, I really can't do that because she's going to be waiting for me there. So I better take an opposite road. So he circles the hill in the opposite direction. And what he doesn't know is that the lady's at the top of the hill watching him do this. Have you ever done that? So she's watching him very calmly, very patiently, and then she starts coming down the hill. And all of a sudden, he stops in his tracks because who is standing in front of him but the lady? And he gets very embarrassed. And the following lines are wonderful because I think all of us, you and I, have had the same experience. We get caught with our hands in the cookie jar, you know, something like that. Well, the lady comes down and he becomes very embarrassed and greeting her says, "My dear lady, how are you this morning? Did you sleep well? I hope you are happy. Cause you some affliction. I want you to know that my uncle is ready to die. And now I'm rushing to Mexico to call one of the beloved priests to come and confess him and prepare him for his death." So he's very apologetic and he's trying to make good. And the lady looks at him and she says the following. She says, "Juan Diego, why do you worry? Don't you know I love you? Don't you know that no matter what happens, I'm here for you? Don't you know that I'm your mother? Don't you know that I'm going to care for you? And don't you realize that even as you and I are talking, that your uncle is already well? I've taken care of that. So you don't have to worry, and no one has to worry that believes and trusts in me, because I love them. But what I want you to do is what I've asked you to do. So don't worry about your uncle, he's fine. And what I want you to do now is you are going to go to the top of the hill that they are. And when you get up to the top, you're going to find some beautiful flowers, and you are to cut them and put them in your tima. It's like a sarape, like a tunic. So you put them in your tunic and you bring them down to me. And then you will go to take these flowers to the bishop." So Juan Diego is excited again because she has comforted him. She has let his heart feel good and happy. And he goes to the top of the hill, not even stopping to think that there's a major problem. And the major problem is that it's December, and it's cold, and flowers don't grow at that time of the year. And they don't grow on the top of the hill because the hill is rocky, and all it has is weeds, and flowers don't grow there. But he's so confident in what the lady has asked him to do that he doesn't stop for a moment. He just goes up the hill. You imagine yourself going up the, was it Copper Hill? And when he gets up there, he finds these beautiful roses. And the roses are so beautiful, they still have the morning dew on them. You know, in the morning when things are wet, like the grass is wet? Well, all that dew is on the roses, and he cuts them. But as he's cutting them, the fragrance is so wonderful, this perfume that comes from the flowers, and he's smelling them. And he's filling them, putting them in his tunic. And he puts up the tunic close to him, and he runs down, and he kneels at the lady's feet, and he opens up the thema, and she takes out every single rose with her hand, and she takes it, and she looks at it, and then she puts it back into the thema. And she goes, now you're to go to the bishop, but you're not to let anyone see these roses except a bishop. So Juan Diego doesn't walk to Mexico City. He is running, and he is excited, and he is happy, and he is just filled with excitement that he is going to show the bishop the sign. But on the way, the roses are so wonderful in their fragrance that every once in a while he stops and opens up a little bit of the tunic just to fill his nostrils with the wonderful fragrance of the roses. And then he keeps running. He gets to Mexico City, to the palace of the bishop, and once again, the servants will not let him in. And this time, they're really angry with him because he's been there several times before. And they've made up their mind that they're going to make him suffer. So they make him suffer, and they make him wait. And Juan Diego walked in feeling like a very proud man, standing up straight, excited. And pretty soon, as the time goes by, he begins to kind of stoop and stoop and stoop and feel more terrible and more terrible. And finally, the bishop finds out that he's waiting and asks him, before that, the servants are curious of what does he have that he's holding so tightly to this demon. So they ask him, please, let us see what you have. And he goes, no, he can't. But finally, they tease him so terribly that he has to show them at least a little bit. So he opens up the tunic, and there they see these roses. And they're trying to grab the roses, but they can't, because the roses aren't meant for them. It's meant for the bishop. So the bishop invites him in, he comes in, and kneels at the feet of the bishop, opens the tunic, and all these roses come tumbling out of the tunic. And the room is filled with this wonderful fragrance. And the bishop at first sees the roses, but something else catches his attention, and it's the fact that on the front of the sarape that he's wearing, the dima that he's wearing, an image of the lady is painted upon or appears on the very thema, this picture that's here. And this is what the bishop sees. And the bishop falls to his knees and realizes that he has done a terrible thing. He has not believed another human being, the Indian, who has come to talk to him and to tell him about this encounter. And he begs for forgiveness. And soon after, agrees to build a temple for the lady where the lady had asked for it. What we learn from this story are a lot of things. One of them is the lady is not asking for a building. What she's asking for is that a people who have been destroyed be rebuilt. A people who had their dignity and their life taken away, that this would be the restoration of the temple. And that's what the lady is asking for. What else do we learn from this story? There is this wonderful thing about the image of the lady herself. Because when Juan Diego looks at the lady, he realizes that this is like reading one of the sacred books that had paintings, because this was the way the Indian people wrote their stories, through paintings and through the spoken word. And her face is a mixed face, or a mestiza face. She's not totally Indian, but she's not totally Spanish. She's a mixture of these two cultures and these two races that were like at war with each other. And she's trying to be a sign of unity, a sign of reconciliation, but also a sign that says the people that have been produced by this conquest and by this war are now wonderful. This race, this new creation is marvelous, even though the events were terrible, because these people have to be treated with dignity like anyone else is. So these are people that deserve a wonderful treatment. When Juan Diego sees the lady, besides the fact that she speaks to him in his indigenous language, he also can read her. Like you and I read a book, we open a book and we begin to read a story. Well, he reads her. And her face is mestiza. Her mantle is a turquoise blue color, which is the color of nobility, of the sacred. She is standing in front of the sun, which was one of the symbols of the god for the indigenous people. And she's standing on the moon, which is also a symbol of God for the indigenous people. So these are the great symbols, the sun and the moon. And she is in between. She is neither the sun, but she's not the moon. And she's making it possible for a message to be communicated. And what she's saying is, I am a sacred person, and I'm here to communicate a special message to you. Around her waist, there's a black ribbon. The black ribbon was a sign for women when they were with child, when they were pregnant. The indigenous women would wear like a black ribbon around their waist. So he knows that she is expecting child. And we can't see it, but there's a tiny little, like the four-leaf flower that looks like a cross. And for the indigenous people, that little cross was the Indian cross that signified the center of the universe. So she is representing the center of a new creation, of a new universe. And all of her speaks about that. There's a lot more that we can talk about with regard to the image, but that just gives you an idea of how Juan Diego, when he sees her, can read her, and she communicates to him. Now, this happened in 1531, but what do we learn from it? We learn several things. One is that the Indian people find in her hope, find in her a loving presence. They had not experienced that because when the missionaries came and the conquistadores came with them, they were talking about the love of God. But it was very difficult for the Indian people to put the love of God together with the many dead that they were seeing, the brutality that was occurring. So they could not accept this God of love, because the actions and the behavior were not compatible. So we might think that God, who in his mercy wants us to be loved, wants us to be close to him, does not want us to suffer, wants us to be comforted, wants us to feel like wonderful people and good people, the lady, so that they could see in her the love of God, so that they could see the compassion of God, so that they could feel that God had not forsaken them, that God had not left them alone in this terrible time of defeat and conquest. And the lady represents all that for them and more. So the Indian people identified with her. The mestizos, those who are of Indian and Spanish blood, see in her face their own reflection and can identify with her. And interestingly enough, the sons and daughters of the Spaniards who had left Spain and come to the New World, their sons and daughters were born there. But they weren't born in Spain. They didn't know what the country of their father, of their parents was like. So they felt distant from the traditions of their parents. And in some ways, they felt like second-class citizens. And so in the lady, they found something and someone they could identify with, someone that they could make their own and claim for their own. So they themselves see in her a special presence and can identify with her. The accounts also tell us that shortly after this apparition, there are more baptisms, a more invited way to Christianity that had been experienced through the lady, Guadalupe. And in our contemporary society, or our more contemporary history, there are many instances where this lady is for people, for many Hispanic people, a sign of hope and compassion and justice and solidarity and unity and reconciliation and many other things, just the way she was with Juan Diego. We know that when Father Miguel Hidalgo, who was a priest, was trying to help the Mexican people fight for their independence from Spain, what's the first thing he does? There's the Grito of Dolores, which is a cry of independence. And he carries, in this protest, a picture and a banner of Our Lady of Guadalupe. What happens with the farm workers, with Cesar Chavez, when they are on strike? They carry a banner or a picture of Our Lady of Guadalupe because she's a symbol of all the things that I've already said to you. And through history, in many Latino and Hispanic communities, Our Lady stands for that. She reminds us that justice is possible. She reminds us that we have a place. She reminds us that the poor do not need to suffer. She reminds us that we can feel like good people and people that have respect and so forth. And once a year, there's a special, special celebration that takes place. Now, it's not that we only think about her once a year, but on December 12th, we have a remembrance again when she appears to Juan Diego and has all these wonderful promises done to be realized. So across the country here in the United States and in Mexico particularly, very early in the morning. I was in Chicago for a long time, and in December, it's a very cold time of the month. It's snowy, and it's freezing. And you go into one of the neighborhoods where there's one of the churches, and you will see people coming out of their homes at 4 o'clock, 4:30 in the morning, because they're on their way to church to celebrate the birthday of Guadalupe, because on this day she appeared. And they're carrying their children wrapped up in blankets in this freezing cold, and the grandmothers and the older people and the younger people all are coming down the street to come to church. And around 5 o'clock in the morning, they sing to her this special birthday song that's called Las Mañanitas. It's the morning song. And they sing again how wonderful it was that she appeared and what she has brought to the Hispanic peoples and to other peoples that look toward her for consolation and for justice and for comfort and for all these wonderful things that we want in our lives. And all day long, it's a celebration because we are happy that she has appeared to us and that she is part of our life, and that she helps us through good times and through bad times. So December the 12th is better than the 4th of July for Hispanics. Can you believe? Mm-hmm. Better than Christmas. Better than a lot of things, because on that day we remember once again that Guadalupe is part of our lives. So that in a nutshell is a little bit about the story and the importance of Guadalupe. And you may have questions which I'd be happy to answer, but I also think it would be important for all of us to think about the following. For the Latino community, Guadalupe is important, and she is a symbol of all things that I've described, and a real companion in our journey. She can be a friend, a companion, a mother, a sister, someone that just listens to us when we talk to her. But in your own lives, is there a religious symbol or something sacred that you look toward that gives you the same kind of presence that she gives to many of us? So you can ask me questions about the account itself, but you might also want to reflect on that question for yourselves. Yes.
I'm just growing into more, encountering more and more Hispanic spirituality, and the sense of surrealista, you know, the surreal qualities that seem to be interwoven throughout Our Lady of Guadalupe. I think is, you know, I see as a prime example. I don't get it, you know. I was just saying earlier, I don't disbelieve. Mm-hmm. And I suspend my disbelief, mm-hmm. but I don't get it. And
yes, and that happens with religious symbols, that the people that get it are the ones for whom it's part of their life and their religious experience. For others, we're invited into it slowly, and we gradually understand it in different ways. But we may not get it all together. But we can learn, or at least appreciate that for some people, this is of wonderful importance. And maybe there's something there, a lesson to be learned.
I think the indigenous people didn't get the Christ on the crucifix. You know, they couldn't deal with that. What kind of God was that that was tortured and killed and nailed to a cross by his own people? Uh-huh. When they, before they come to the Spaniards, they worshiped Tonantzin passionately, almost to the point of obsession. And then when the temples were destroyed, they didn't forget her. And then, all of a sudden, this image was offered to them of La Virgen de Guadalupe, and they embraced La Virgen de Guadalupe just like they embraced Tonantzin. So therefore, when all hope was gone, all of a sudden, there was hope for the indigenous people, and the product of the rape of Mexico, those people too. There was nothing left. There was nothing after the conquest. There was nothing but death. You know, the Indians that weren't killed physically on purpose for some reason or another, for 150 years after conquest, there was relentless disease that wiped out whole villages, whole families. They knew nothing but death. There was no hope. And that's one thing that people today, we don't realize the scope, the dimension of the suffering of the people of Mexico and all of Indian America. It seems so easily dismissed and forgotten.
Yes. A lot of people don't realize how detailed and ornate the drawing of the Virgen of Guadalupe actually was. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about it, because a lot of people don't realize the detail and a lot of the things that were in the image that were later to be discovered now in the future with technology that they couldn't do, you know, hundreds of years ago when the image was first discovered.
Today, there's a lot of new study taking place that's helping us recover or retrieve a lot of the original meaning of the account, because one of the important things to remember is the event happens. The way the indigenous people communicated was primarily through the spoken word and the painted image. And in the community, the artists were very respected because they could paint about the sacred. They could paint about the story of the community and so forth. So now they're doing these studies that try to go back to the indigenous account orally of the story, which would be in the Nahuatl language. And we begin to discover symbolism in the story that we have not understood before. Like one example, I mean, Quetzal is talking about the image, but one example. When I told you in the beginning of the story that it was very early dawn, well, that's very important because I want you to try and imagine if you were to stay up all night waiting for the sun to come up for the first moment of dawn, do you think it's possible to capture the first ray of sunshine in early dawn? Would you know when night ended and when dawn started? You could try it tonight, I don't know. But you probably couldn't. And in the Indian world, they believed that whatever that split second of time was, when night turned into early dawn, that was a very special moment for new creation to take place, for something wonderful to take place and to occur, for the transformation of the world as they knew it into something beautiful and marvelous. And that's exactly at that moment when Guadalupe, the lady, appears to Juan Diego. So there's all this rich symbolism in the account itself. There are some studies that they have done, I think this is what Katsai is referring to, on the eyes of Our Lady, because she's looking down, she has her hand folded, which is a very respectful sign, gesture, and her eyes are cast down. Well, they've studied the eyes, and they've actually found, like using a photography technique, that they can see like a negative inside the eye, the pupil of the eye, and they see like little shadows of people, which they believe was probably one of them could be the bishop and a couple of people that accompanied him when the event takes place, when the roses are given to the bishop and the image appears on her mantle. For those of us for which this devotion and event is part of our lives, no matter how they explain it or don't explain it, we believe it. It's part of who we are, and there's no questioning. Just like you, like all of us may not question the fact that Jesus died and Jesus rose. You say, how do you explain that? Well, Jesus died and Jesus rose. And we might try and explain it, but basically, Jesus died and Jesus rose. But we say the same thing. Guadalupe appeared. And there are different ways that perhaps we can understand the fullness of the message. But it's a matter of faith. It's a matter of our belief.
Do they think of this as a manifestation of the Holy Spirit? From where I come from, it just seems very natural to think of the Holy Spirit as a feminine side of the triune God. It doesn't seem hard to believe at all.
In the church, in the Catholic Church, Guadalupe is accepted and accepted as Mary, Our Lady of Guadalupe, Mary under that title. In the account itself, I think we can't ignore the indigenous roots of it, the Donantzin. But Donantzin was the sacred manifestation of the divine as well. And ultimately, maybe we have to think about the fact, again, that God is greater than how we could possibly ever imagine. And that somehow God is not going to leave his people forsaken. And that he did send the lady, Guadalupe, if you want, Mary, to be a source of consolation and of comfort to the people, of hope.
It's occurred to me that at the same time that this was happening, Martin Luther was at the height of his career over in Germany. And since so many people in this room have assumptions that are shaped by the worldview that has come down to us from Protestantism, I'm very, which includes myself, I think there in Protestantism there has been such that came out of a movement which wanted so much to
put Christ at the center, mm-hmm. and to you know, return to biblical sources and so on, that we've tended not to be open to the other parts of the Christian tradition, which are very much part of the fullness of Christianity overall. So I'm tremendously drawn as a Protestant to the feminine example, which our forefathers, shall we say, kind of stamped down. I'm very, very drawn to that. I also think that, you know, some of Protestantism led into more dry and modern forms of culture and society, whereas there's this, you know, more colorful form. But that if we use our imagination, then we can see relating to the heart of the Christian message, even though the symbols that different groups are comfortable with might be different. Roberta Bondi's sessions are doing something similar and saying, you know, some of the ancient stuff that sounds kind of weird to modern Protestant people is also part of our tradition. So there's a wonderful kind of broadening of what could imply in some of this, and I think it's wonderful to try to imagine our way into it and gain from it.
Yes. Another aspect that comes in too is I think that okay, we're victims of the conquest also, insofar as if we go over there into the little reading room today and look at USA Today, how many articles are we going to find in Latin America compared to the articles that we find in Asia and Europe, certainly, and other parts of the world? I think that there has been some sort of screening of us from the realities of the history of Latin America. And you might attribute it to guilt, you might attribute it to our own genealogy coming so much from Europe. So many different reasons, but in fact, we are vastly ignorant of Latin America. And we don't have a sense of it. And yet, it's our contiguous landmass. You know, it's us. It really is us, and in some ways we've been denied our own richness by our ignorance. And I'm a social studies teacher, and it's only recently that we even do anything about the history of Mexico or Latin America. And yet, I bet we can all talk about the history of England and the history of Germany and France. You know, and so all of our spirituality is wrapped up in our historical perspectives as well, should bring up Martin Luther. I think that comes into play too.
I have three more hands and about three more minutes. So, and then yourself and Roberta.
You know, the question you had posed to us was what figure guides us? And I suspect the reason that this room is so crowded tonight is that we don't have any. And I think everybody's hungry for someone like this, and I kind of think maybe that's our tradition doesn't, you know, we don't have Mary in our tradition. We don't have anyone, and I think we're looking.
You said that even today people still don't understand the scope, like my father was saying, of the destruction of not even just Latin America, also in North America where we are today. People, you know, in history class, you know, I know that in my history classes I never learned or was ever even given a clue to about the killing or the conquest or what exactly happened to the native people and their religion taken away, all their rights taken away. Everything they believed in was destroyed. And for the conquerors to just assume that their way was right and that they were the righteous and that it was their way and no other way. And, you know, even now as people for hire to realize that, you know, I know a lot of people like probably didn't even know what happened in Mexico City, but that was only one small part of what happened through North and South America alike.
The one little piece that I should just add is the other group of people who were terribly affected were the African, because the Africans were brought into the Americas for slave labor. Because the Indians were so brutally treated that they were practically destroyed and in many cases disappeared. And so the Africans come in, so they are also part of our history and part of our makeup, physical makeup.
It was a priest who said, you know, finally, you know, the Indians were all being slaughtered, and so the only way you could think to save them was to bring in Africans.
Roberta.
I love the image of the confrontation, the way the story is building up. The bishop won't see him, and the servants of the bishop won't let him in, and there's going to be a sign, and as we would be accustomed to expecting the story to go out of a more European base, what we expect is a sign to be, he opens his cloak and all the servants drop dead. a huge sword comes out, or flames, or something like that. But he opens it and there's roses, you know, and that is just wonderful. A wonderful, a sort of a visual parallel to the cross. It's parallel to the cross, that we're saved not by the sword, but by roses.
The last little part to that is, there's so much to the account itself that it's impossible to do it like in one little session, but following the flowers coming out of the theme and so forth and the bishop meeting, the bishop does something which is unheard of. And one is he invites Juan Diego to stay in his house that evening, overnight, in the account. And the following day, or after a couple of days, he actually goes to where Juan Diego lives, which is on the outskirts, among the poor, to see the uncle who had been ill. And that symbolically is saying that the bishop opens himself up to this reality and tries to respond to it in the manner that the lady wishes, because that's the real message. The real miracle is that the indigenous people should be restored their dignity. That's the real temple. It's not the temple that was built, but that there's a restoration. And 500 years later, we're still wrestling that message become real. And, well, thank you so much for your good attention and great participation. And I hope you have a wonderful evening and lots more to think about. And have a good day.